Thank you. Tonight we have new data and some old data. And thought we had better take a summation tonight. Find out, to be grammatical, where we are at. And discover a few things, a few new things. Little orientation is very definitely in order. And so, call tonight's lecture an analysis of memory and human aberration and psychosomatic illness. Memory and its relationship, in other words, to a person's ability to handle himself in present time. As you know, processing has taken a very definite shift of emphasis in the past months. It has done this to a large degree on the basis of, well, let me be very frank with you, metering. How much of this stuff has to be handed out? How much does an individual have to know in order to make a good, clean job of processing? How much does a person have to know something about this subject called knowledge? As you know, this science grows out of knowledge itself. Epistemology. It's a nice technical word. At the same time, it means a great deal. Epistemology was one of the big question mark subjects of the field of philosophy. It was the least known and the least integrated subject in philosophy. And yet epistemology embraces even philosophy itself, so that you can see it was a big subject. Very little was known about it. At the time of address to these problems, actually, very little was known about the human mind. Compared to what we know about the human mind now, it's about the same ratio as a kid down here knows about his hot rod and what an Aborigine suddenly snatched out of the wilderness of Australia would know about a new Cadillac carburation system. In short, with this subject on the field of the human mind, we have done a considerable jump for man. In this, it should become apparent to you immediately, as one of the first and foremost points of epistemology, knowledge, that the computer of, the retainer of, the vessel which holds knowledge is the human mind, and the thing which uses knowledge is the human body. It's all very well for somebody like Kant, great fellow Kant, no wonder he couldn't, he had a name like that, to go out and say, well, all that's worth knowing in the whole subject of the human race, anything that's worth knowing transcends human experience. Therefore, can never be contacted by man. Boy, was he an apathy. That was 165 years ago that Immanuel Kant, nicknamed the great Chinaman of Königsberg, that's right, that was his nickname, made this astounding fatuosity. And he stopped an investigation of knowledge at that point, 165 years ago, by attempting to lay down a code which had as its first principle that knowledge is beyond the realm of human experience and therefore can never be contacted by a human mind. He went on from there with the most terrifically resounding phrases, sounding brass and the tinkling of the temple bell, and stopped the forward progress of thought with sentences which have to be read with a piece of cardboard. You take the piece of cardboard, you close out the two center adverbial clauses. And you take another piece of cardboard, you knock out about four more participial phrases, and then you find out what it says by the time you have put the verb on the front part where it belongs. It sounds awfully good, like one of Hitler's speeches, but when taken all apart, it fell down to the terrific simplicity. The whole philosophy fell down to the terrific simplicity. Man is moral out of an innate morality, which is completely selfless and altruistic, and for which he gets bounteously paid. He writes Book One and says it's completely altruistic and inherent and innate and so forth, and then wrote Book Two to tell you why it had to be and why you got paid for it and how you better have this innate thing because you'd get paid for it if you had it. The last few paragraphs I've set up here, they make very good sense to you? Well, they really don't. Because there's no sense in them beyond this one point. But 165 years ago, out of the terrific altitude of a university at Königsberg, a philosopher pretended to lay down the rules of human behavior by saying that nobody could understand them, and laid them down with so much force, so much thunder, that ever afterwards, people stayed in a state of apathy about it. Science, through those 165 years, began to kill a dog called superstition. Whether the scientist knows it or not, that's his goal. The death of superstition and the birth of knowledge, the birth of data. Science, no matter how moldy and moth-eaten the gray tweed suits are of the individuals in universities practicing it, no matter how humble these fellows seem to be, these scientists are wild-eyed zealots. They are killing the dragon superstition. We used to have a subject known as natural philosophy. Some of the early Greeks worked with it, made some nice observations, did very little experimentation. Aristotelian material came up through the Dark Ages, purveyed by the churches as a contribution, picked up by a fellow by the name of Francis Bacon, picked up again by a fellow by the name of Newton. And all of a sudden, there was a group of men in the world who had as their sole goal and mission the death of unknowns, the death of superstition. These boys are wild-eyed. They don't even know what they're tackling, most of them. And yet, tell one of them, this is not within the realms of mathematics. This is not within the embrace of human understanding. And although he has stood before many classes, and although he's a cowed little man in front of the faculty, this fellow will start frothing. He just starts frothing. His concept of existence is simply on the basis that it's knowable. We can find out. I can figure it out here on a mathematical pad. I can do it on my slide rule. It's knowable. There's a reason why cats, kings, and coal heavers and cockroaches behave as they do, act as they do. There are certain natural laws. You know, it's a strange observation, but that nation and that society is the most prosperous which knows the most about the material universe and uses the least superstition. That nation which uses superstition as its modus operandi in tackling the world, let's go out and propitiate the gods. Let's all lie down and be walked on. Let's make sure no black cats walk across this path. Let's make sure that when we pass under a tree bearing mistletoe, we go. Because if you don't, oh. Now, maybe you could fool somebody in Kenningsburg. Transportation's gotten better since the days of Immanuel Kant. I took a look. I found nations meshed with superstition. China. I've seen in China men working as beasts of burden. The cold, bitter winds of the Gobi coming down and tearing through their thin, lice-strewn garments, while they wore a rope over their shoulders and pulled a stone boat. And at home they had the household gods. And when they walked down the street, no longer pulling that stone boat, you would see one of them occasionally duck sideways in a doorway and come out by another doorway. Why did he do that? So the devils wouldn't catch up with him, because everyone knows that a devil must travel in a straight line. And as soon as he makes a crooked line, then the devil can't follow him. I've seen Chinese junks cut across the bows of big U.S. freighters just so the devils would be cut off and wouldn't be able to follow him. Junk goes under the bows. The fourth mate happens to be on the bridge. He doesn't bother to bring the engines back to stop. There's a dull crunch. 4, 6, 16 Chinamen are suddenly in the Huang Po, which never gives up its living or dead. Yeah, that's superstition at work. Been down the jungles of Haiti. Almost hardly any town in Haiti where you cannot hear during the night the throb of voodoo drums. Those people are barefoot, and they starve, and their little kids run around with sand fleas eaten into their skin. They've got what they know as rice stomachs. They die off by the thousands of dysentery, malaria, so on. They sleep in huts where, if you lay down, you would probably be a very sick person indeed. It's not pleasant to have cockroaches walk over you all night. This is superstition reigning. And here in the United States, where the God has suddenly become, we can know. We can know. You can go to almost any city in this country and open the water tap, take a drink of water, fill a glass with it, drink that water with perfect confidence. You're not going to get sick. No gods are going to afflict you. That's because there were some engineers who happened to know about bacteria, who put sand traps in, and who test that water for bacteria. You can go down here and you can eat in a restaurant without any fear whatsoever that tomorrow you will be dying of Asiatic cholera. And that isn't because we just don't have it in this country. Since there was an epidemic in that most untropical city of this tropical thing called Asiatic cholera in Chicago not very many years ago. The bug got loose. There we were. That's a world without superstition. A world with knowledge. Where the attitude of the thinking men of that world, we can know, they are saying. We can find out. And this society per unit individual does not walk down the street in ragged clothes with the winds of Michigan blowing through his every bone, pulling a stone boat as a beast of burden. It's a big difference. Maybe some of you who haven't seen this sort of thing aren't as impressed by it as you might be. But during the last 75 years, something new has been born upon this earth. And it's the philosophy of we can know. And in Dianetics, we study the background logic of knowing. It just happens, incidentally, that the human mind gets embraced in what is knowledge. The human mind gets embraced by this merely because it's the vessel and the computer of knowledge. So you want to turn out better abilities to think. You want to turn out better processes of thought, raise the level of health and so forth. You treat the human mind. But it's incidental. You are studying on an echelon, those of you who are deep students of this subject, you're studying on an echelon that philosophers of the past would look at you with considerable awe the second that you demonstrated a phenomenon or two. They would say, my God, witches, devils, burning at the stake. You can take the oldest, crudest, worst technique we've got and make an effective thrust into a primitive society with it, which will leave people somewhat staggered. Tonight I'm not going to talk to you about an old moth-eaten technique. I'm going to talk to you about brand new, shiny techniques which are visible all around the horizon. Because it doesn't take very long to tell you about them. It's true that in any subject, the more one knows of the subject itself, the more he can extrapolate or figure out from a few data. Thus goes this science at this time, as far as processing itself are concerned. We have to the sum of, I think, 209 axioms that embrace epistemology pretty well. Don't let me hear about change, because actually there's merely been an improvement on old material with that. That's not very new, the material in that. The codification of it and sudden presentation to you, these 209 axioms, that is rather new, all together in a pile. Processes as they relate to a human being are figured out from these axioms, and you can figure out a lot more processes than there now exist. This is like the difference between inventing a mathematics and using the mathematics to solve a particular problem. Now, with this mathematics of these 209 axioms, we are actually resolving the problems as they relate to one peculiar, particular, little, tiny sphere. So be it. The human mind. How can it think better? The overall subject can tell you how to live better and better interpersonal relations, and it tells you how to put together a nation or two, and it tells you a lot of things that are interesting, such as how to draw a picture that will always win the prize. But because there is a change of emphasis in processing itself, it doesn't change the overall subject at all. And you've seen recently quite a few changes, improvements. Each one of them is a higher echelon button. I have tonight a higher button than any I have given you before. This is a better button. Before you can know about this button, you should take a quick glance at the subject and find out what we're trying to do. What are we trying to do? What is a human memory? How do you get one? And what do you do with it? Human memory is a very simple thing. You have upwards toward 100 channels of perception of you and your environment. There's sight, sound, hearing, tactile, saline content, joint position, magnetic orientation. Oh, there's all sorts of them. There's a long list. They all operate simultaneously, and they record straight on through. Unless, of course, the mechanism by which the sense channel is itself cut by some psychiatrist. All right. Here is a unit observer put in here. Here's the physical universe, whatever it is. Physical universe. This unit observer, by sight, sees the physical universe. He hears it by sound. He can feel it manually. He feels the temperature of the physical universe and so forth. Now, all these things come in physical universe waves. That is to say, sight comes in on the wavelengths of light. They're very easy to handle. Sound comes in on the wavelengths of sound. They're force waves traveling through the air. Now, what is a memory? It would be a unit recording by a unit observer. Here is a unit observer, and here is just one recording. That recording, by the way, can be moving. Let's take a unit recording, the period of 5 minutes, or something like that. It can be a time factor recording. Now, for 5 minutes, then he records everything that's going on, all motion, everything else in this physical universe. And what's he do with it? Now, that's the recording of a memory. But what's he do with his memory after it's recorded? That's where everybody's broken down. They've really broken down on this one in the past. Right there is superstition. Devils, demons, things that go boomp in the night. Lord knows what happens. The scientist comes along and advances the imponderable and says, as I made a mistake in saying early in this business, it's recorded in a cell. The cells record it. No, they don't. The first place, there isn't a wavelength small enough to record it in a thing as small as the cell. And the next thing is, these cells perpetually die and are replaced. Even the protein molecules of a neuron, your psychiatrist being rather relatively uneducated and a scientist, being part of an old superstition, says the neuron is born with the human being and lasts until he dies. So therefore, it never changes. Well, you can take a Ford car out here, and by the time you have driven it 20 years, I guarantee there won't be many of the original parts left on it. But you could say it's the same Ford car. That's what's true with one of these neurons. In other words, a human nerve. This human nerve is made up of organic chemical compounds. And these chemical compounds consist, well, protein molecules and all sorts of things. They are in a definite order in this neuron. This neuron is actually a living being within a living being. But then that's true of anything in a human being. The human being is composed of these colonies of living beings. Well, here's one neuron. It replaces itself chemically, often. You could say, yes, it's the same neuron. Just like you could say, yes, that's the same Ford car. But everything in it has been replaced. There have been some fancy theories. Not one of them has ever accounted for anything. We look at the phenomena of the mind and we discover something very strange. We discover that the human being is activated by something which does not have wavelength or position in space and time. I won't go ahead with proving this. It's another subject. That we call theta. It's a unit. A unit infinity is what it is. But it actually makes a facsimile. It takes a picture and stores a picture. See, we just get around this problem by saying, let's take it functionally. Let's not try to be so darned superstitious that we believe man was made out of clay and always will be clay. Let's just look around and see what kind of a mechanism it would really take to do this, and then test the mechanism and find out if that is the mechanism. We test it, we find out this thing does answer all the conditions necessary to human memory. Therefore, it must be somewhere close to the truth. So what happens here? This individual takes a recording, physical recording, and then it translates into a theta recording. it records in something of infinity, depth, breadth, and so forth. It's very interesting. You can go back and you can look at your memories, and by re-examining your memories, you don't change the physical universe any. Well, this is, as far as we can tell at this time, life source. All right. Recording is done then in the physical universe and is all of a sudden recorded on material which is imperishable. That recording, done in theta, contains sound, tactile, hearing, all the rest of it. If you don't believe this, you can return an individual to these units. Recordings, they can find them again, hear them again, so forth. What's very interesting, you conduct this examination amongst children, you'd be astonished. Most of them have this facility, very, very large. They're not taking things out of the cells, they're taking things out of a nothing which is infinity. By the way, this is mathematically quite precise. All right, we've got then a memory. When a man takes a recording, he has a potential memory. He can remember it. How does he remember it? Well, back in the days of superstition, they would have you believe that man was a stimulus-response mechanism. Environment stimulated something, he responded. I'm afraid this was the wish of the people who ruled men, not the truth. The wish was that if we hold up a red flag, the populace jumps 2 paces to the right. We hold up a blue flag, the populace jumps 2 paces to the left. When we say hup, they say hope. How easy it is to rule a country, to rule a science, to rule a university student, if you have taught him that he is a stimulus-response mechanism. You've taught him he's messed. You've taught him he's the material universe. You've actually taught him he doesn't have self-determinism and he doesn't have a soul. It's very easy. If I were sitting out in the most malicious, vicious frame of mind imaginable, I could not invent a better slave control mechanism than the psychologist's stimulus response reply to the material universe. It's superstition is what it is, because it's not founded in anything but a cursory observation that people do react to the environment. They even went so far as to say, does a man's glandular monitoring of fear turn on because he runs? Or does he get afraid and then run? Or does he run and then get afraid? All the time postulating that this is just a little machine. All we do is push a couple of buttons and he goes like this. Sits down, works from 9 till 5, votes the right ticket. Only men aren't well when they're like that. They're sick. And they're sick in exact ratio to the amount of stimulus response they give to an environment. And the more they respond to the stimulus of an environment, the sicker they are. And it's an exact ratio. It's precise. You show me an individual who responds automatically to his environment, and I will show you a sick man. Of course, today, he's the normal man. We've all been taught this. They've been taught that there's such a thing as stream of consciousness. That's wonderful. You have one thought, another thought's going to follow it, inevitably. And they just keep following each other just like that through a man's lifetime. He can't do anything about it. That's great. It's not true, except in a person who's pretty badly aberrated. It happens to be that an individual being reasonable does align data and align the field of address. He aligns the data he is handling. And this makes it seem as though there's relationship or association amongst his data. Actually, there's differentiation. The second that he gets association in his data, the second he begins to automatically associate one datum with another datum, mark him off the chart. He's going out through the bottom. Next year, he'll get to be a sophomore.
Okay.
Stimulus response. Here's your tone scale. It's just an arbitrary scale here of human behavior. 24, 0. Here's the individual at this level. This is a plot against time. This is the emotional responses of an individual. Here he's dead. He doesn't have any response. And up here, pretty happy and cheerful. He's still responding to the environment considerably. Up here, he chooses the environment to respond to him. Completely restless. Now, up here, well, unfortunate, this is cause without action up there. I mean, you have to come down the tone scale quite a ways before you get action. Although the person is just static cause up the top. Maybe this is a desirable state, maybe it's not. I tested it out and I find out that an individual tends to chill when he starts going into this state. And that would be natural, too, because nothing in infinity or minus 270 degrees centigrade. That's awfully cold. And a person who starts to go into this is trying to take his body along with him. And, of course, his body is in motion, and motion doesn't exist in that bracket. So, ergo, he gets cold. It's very interesting that you could set a person down, you could teach him to be very still, very quiet, very relaxed. And the more quiet, the more relaxed he is, and so forth. If you really get him to a point where he's starting into the static there, oh, he's good. He's serene. There's no question about it, but he starts to get cold. Sometimes you have to work on him for a day or two to get him speeded up again. It's a very interesting state of being. And down here, an individual sort of goes out through the bottom, goes into apathy and death, and he's dead. This tone scale ought to look like this. They're both the same point. There's different routes of getting to them. One of them's by dying, and the other is by becoming a saint. And your saint is just about as bad off as a dead man. I mean, a person down here in apathy, or a person down here in grief, something like this, demonstrates about the same physiological good condition that a saint demonstrates. And by the way, I've known a few saints. I don't care who I associate with. That's a fact. I have known some saints. Wonderful people, when you could get them into motion to talk. Very serene. But in order to be healthy and well, you have to be down here in the middle bracket of motion. Here, you're self-determining the environment. You have experience. Your body is in good shape. You can even do things about your own body, which are quite remarkable. But the point is that you start to drift down here. You get down here, going toward death. You get into these automatic response mechanisms. Way down here, too, you start to get into anger and so forth, where your survival is badly threatened and you try to destroy. Then you become afraid, and then you decide you've lost it all anyway, and then you become apathetic. And I almost said, call up the local undertaker, but they seldom do. They leave it up to other people even to bury them. Which I think is remarkable when you come to think about it. They care so little, they don't even... Well, no person up here, when he decides to die, by the way, down south, I was talking to an old lady, and she was very, very proud. She had decided that she was going to live a couple of more years. And the reason she had to live a couple more years is because she was going to have one of the biggest funerals they'd seen in that in a long time. She had a tombstone bought and her plot bought and everything. She was all set. She was going to have a coffin with silver handles. Well, silver plated anyway. Well, anyway, she had a very progressive, healthy attitude. I don't think she's dead. I think 20 years from now, I will go back to Savannah and I will find that the undertaker is still taking payments off of her. All right. This is then a scale of motion. It runs from no motion to optimum motion and down to no motion again. But it's also a scale of self-determinism. It's a scale of self-determinism in this wise. It just keeps on going up in the activity, the amount of self-determinism available. Evidently, it goes all the way up toward the top, although I wouldn't guarantee that. I haven't been dead recently, so I haven't found out. Anyway, as you go on up the line, a person's self-determinism increases. But in here, what changes is the emphasis of his self-determinism. It shifts with regard to the environment. Here it's directed very punitively, very actively against the environment. That is to say, the material universe, the living organisms around it. Here an individual is on a full-out attack against life. As he comes up here, he neglects more and more the physical universe. Takes on less and less motion. Takes on less and less activity. Until finally, he just sits down, taking on no activity at all. Here, he is being self-determined in its most utter, widest, furthest sense. He actually gets capable of self-determining on enormously broad spheres. He can determine terrific things, but he doesn't want to, which is the hooker. And as we go down the tone scale, we find out an individual's ability to control the environment decreases. The ability to control the environment decreases down to about 3-5. And at this point starts turning around to where it is much more the control of the individual by his environment. And he's more and more controlled by the environment until he gets down to about 2. And at this point, in this bracket from here to here, is your stimulus response. This is the environment controlling the individual to some degree. Something happens in the environment, the individual acts evidently without his present time self-determinism intervening. In other words, he responds automatically. Automatic response sets in. Somebody drops a teacup, he says, damn. There isn't any observable interval of thought in there. He's just a puppet. When he gets down below 2, he and then the environment are practically the same thing. As the environment goes, so does he go. Whatever happens in the environment, he reacts to it. No reason at all. The quality of a person's reason at this level is fantastically bad. Very bad. The speed at which they can operate, think, react, and so forth, is very slow. It's so common in this society for a person to be running that slow that the person who runs a little bit faster is looked at as abnormal, and why not? The speed of a person who is out there driving those cars, it's very, very poor. You know, you're driving cars on the road with people whose reaction time is half a second, 3/4 of a second, 2 seconds. Think of what this means. How far does a car travel going 60 miles an hour in this space of time? 1, 2, and 3. How far does that car travel? Long ways. You got a society that's got people in them driving cars at that speed with that reaction time. Everybody else is driving at that speed, so they drive at that speed. That's about all the reason there is to it. And they can't control a car at that speed. You know, a sixth of a second in terms of reaction time is considered to be very good. You take a test, you take a dollar bill. let somebody hold it up here, and you hold your fingers apart, and you drop that dollar bill. Try to close your fingers on it the second this person lets go. Don't know quite where it hits. I think if it hits center. No. To hit the upper edge of it, it's somewhere around a sixth of a second. I tested these things one time, and I don't remember what they were. You hit the upper edge of them. If you can catch that bill, you've got a fifth to a sixth of a second reaction. If you catch the middle of it, you've got about an eighth of a second reaction. And if you catch the bottom of it, you've got about a tenth of a second reaction. And do you know that you're traveling too slow the whole time? None of those reaction speeds are fast enough to throw a jet plane around with. Yet the boys running these jet planes, they're young. They run a sixth, an eighth, something like that, most of them. All this, the specific numbers I'm using with regard to reaction time are based upon certain researches, by the way, which I do not trust. So don't take those numbers literally. It's just the theory I'm giving you. I don't trust these figures. They were done by Cornell, I think. Anyway, as you come down the tone scale here, here a person is so thoroughly responsive to the material universe that he responds 100%. Material universe says this, he responds with that. Bing, 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 bing. How dull. These people are pretty easy to control, by the way. Your hypnotic band is down here at about 0.5 to 1.0. He does a revolt there at about 1.0, 1.1, something like that, and he won't be hypnotized. That's because he's in somebody else's rapport. Somebody else has already done it to him. Now, actually, until you get well above 2.0, you don't have a well human being. I mean, the person is so consistently driven by psychosomatic illnesses, which he thinks are pains, odds and ends, illnesses of various descriptions. He's in pretty bad shape in general. All right, what's this got to do with what is a memory? Well, it has a great deal to do with what is a memory. Here a person has stood and recorded a theta facsimile. That's a very fancy name. Facsimile simply means, as you know, you tear off a box top or make a facsimile of it and send it in. In other words, it means something similar to. Trying to impress it with you that these memories are not the actual thing. These memories are pictures of the actual thing. Now, down here, a person records the universe around him is handling his facsimiles. You get the idea. Stimulus response. He sees a black cat. This is bad luck, so he wrecks his car. I mean, just automatic. No thought involved in it at all. Somebody says alligator, and this automatically brings him a memory of alligators or re-stimulates him in some way. And the odd part of it is that all of the physical effort facsimiles are the easiest to re-stimulate in this individual. Here, we say a word to the person, he gets the facsimile immediately. Bing, 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 bing. Up here, stimulus response. He's operating a little bit better on self-determinism. Just a shade better, so that he can select what facsimile. You say alligator to him, he can select the facsimile of whether or not he was at the alligator farm, or whether or not it was an alligator suitcase, or whether or not alligators are something that you chase away with bromo seltzer. In other words, he has some choice over the theta facsimiles. But when he gets a tough one, when the universe gets tough for him, the tough facsimiles are stimulus response. All I'm trying to demonstrate is that down here, every memory is handled by the material universe. Everyone. He sees something in the universe, he gets the identical memory to it, back and forth. Language is identical to him. All symbols equal, all language equal everything. It's gorgeous. Horrible mess. That's an automatic response. But here, only in the band above two, only the painful ones, the physical effort ones, and so forth. A memory. All right, let's take now, what is a unit memory? An individual goes out, he sits down in an automobile, he drives off, he runs into the road, and a normal is driving along the other side of the road, and of course he gets hit, and he bumps his head on the steering wheel, and the bill for repairs is $162, which he has to pay. He goes into a court, which is always awfully stimulus response and so forth, has to pay the other guy's damages too. All this is very painful. It's a package called Automobile Wreck 16. So he walks down the road. Mind you, now he hit his head. That's part of the memory. Nothing strange about this memory just because he got hit in the head. He's recorded it all. All right. He goes down the road. He passes by an automobile that's been hit. Now, if this gentleman were at about here, the upper bracket of this, practically at four, he goes past this automobile that's been hit. You know, standard American wreck. Blood all over the road, bodies littered into the ditch, police cars there arguing with people, sirens going all over the place, broken glass all around. The automobile manufacturer can sell another car, you know. So he looks at this, and he drives on down the road, and he gets down the road a mile, or he gets down the road till the next day, and the first thing you know, he's got a headache. And he says, how could I possibly have that? I don't know how I could have a headache. I'm sane. I'm normal. I know what it was. I had fish for dinner last night. I must be allergic to them. That's what it is. It's just about the process of thought that goes on about these memories. Truth of the matter is, he saw the wreck. The wreck was enough of a punch in the environment to call up to this individual his unit memory of having had a wreck, and part of that unit memory is a headache, so he gets it all back automatically. There's the environment controls the individual to the extent of bringing up these unit memories. Now this individual goes along. This individual is pretty self-determined. But it so happens at one time he was the only survivor of an 18-passenger airplane crash, and bodies were all littered over the mountainside, and, you know, standard beacon story. He watched several people die in agony. He had a broken leg, and his back was pretty well broken. It took him days to get to him, and he's finally borne down the mountainside on donkey back. In other words, a unit experience, but a real rough one. Well, he's up clear up to here. And a close relative is in an airplane crash, and then he gets a backache. Goes to the doctor says it's arthritis. Doctors are, well. But there is the unit memory called in. Now, the unit memory moves in on him. What's he do about it? Nothing, because he doesn't even, quote, know, unquote, that it is there. Unit memory. Now, there are ways to handle these unit memories. You can do all sorts of things to them. Actually, they're a whole package. You can run out all the perceptions, all the pain, all the physical effort, the weight, everything else. You can run the whole thing. You can bring this package up. An auditor can take this, give it to the individual, let him run all the way through it, and re-experience it. Now, what's happening is a very simple thing. You have a theta facsimile, which is just more or less of a light engraving of an incident, which nevertheless contains pain and all the rest of it. That's a unit memory. And the second that that thing is run into the vibration level of present time, which can be fairly calm sometimes, and it's run over it thoroughly, it's just as though present time, with its actuality and reality, were an eraser, which is erasing the traces off the engraving. It's so simple. There's nothing to this. You just bring the old theta facsimile up, and it just doesn't match present time. You run it through a few times, and bong, it washes up. The only unfortunate part about it is people have thousands of them. That's too long a process. All right, let's take the next one. How does a person get up there? Now, the emotional state of the individual himself is the glue by which he can glue together his lifespan, and which he can uses to glue onto one of these facsimiles and hold it there. An emotional state. In other words, the secondary characteristic of these states is... there's one other one intervening in there, and that's you can just take the physical effort out of it. You can just work the physical effort out of it, and you also knock it to pieces. Same way. And this emotional one is a very interesting one, though. The individual is angry, and he has a tendency to inherit suddenly theta facsimiles of anger, these unit memories of anger. If he is happy, he tends to pick up unit memories of happiness, and so on. In other words, he picks up the memories in response to his present time emotion. There is some truth in the fact that if you just sit there and grin like an idiot for a while, say, I'm happy, all of a sudden, you'll have a lot of happy memories turn up. Yeah, because you're just supplying the emotional glue. You're artificially bringing up this business about happiness, and you make yourself feel happy. Not just say I'm happy, but feel happy. And you feel happy hard enough, and you'll remember some happy incidents. What you've done is taken the emotion of happiness. You see, your emotion of happiness probably compares to how happy you would be, by the way, about the same way apathy appears to anger. I mean, it's a big bridge toward how happy you can be and how happy you are or have been. You can be a lot happier than you ever have been. It's essential. You can get up into such a state that it's wonderful to behold. I was in it once. I was in it for about 6 months once. I kept trying to explain it to myself. I said, let's see, Carl Menninger says that euphoria is very bad. I must be in a state of euphoria. Very bad, extreme happiness. The only trouble with it is I'm writing about 10,000 words a day. I'm selling everything I write. Everybody I meet likes me. I'm getting along fine. I figure everything out. If I walk near a piece of machinery and turn the key on, it'll start even though it's been dead for somebody else for a long time. And everybody's very pleased with this, including me, so this can't be euphoria. In other words, it was so far up the line, I just distrusted the devil out of it. And I finally distrusted it enough so it went away. Anyway, in short, here's what we have here. We have glue that we call emotion. Now, emotion is the thought response to motion. This is very simple. We shouldn't make it very complicated. Here is the awareness unit of the mind, the command post, the point right now that tells you where you are and listen to what I'm saying and so forth. That's the command post of the mind, I. That's your self-determinism and so forth. Now here's motor switchboard, endocrine switchboard, so forth, up here. And that's part of your physical being. Well, I is not part of your physical being. It's your theta being. And I translates its orders to the body by calling for an emotion, and the endocrine system then turns on the motor switchboard. This is very, very easily tested and proven. You can, by the way, take all of the adrenaline you want. You can just start shooting a person full of it. And if he is determined to be inactive, no good. Nothing's going to happen. He has decided not to be active, and you're shooting him with the stuff that calls for physical action. But it isn't relayed through this switchboard, and it isn't at the command of this, so you're not going to get action with it. But a person has to be pretty well up the tone scale before he does that. You take somebody who is way down the tone scale, and you shoot him with a little bit of adrenaline, and he'll immediately get active. That's because he's controlled by the environment. You can be the environment. All right. Now, your individual then sends out his orders to this emotional endocrine system, and you get action. action occurs and it'll translate back into motion, and I can take it or it doesn't take it. It doesn't matter one way or the other. All right. Now, when you get action in here, you've got a certain amount then of emotional response which is mixed up in this action. Well, now that's glue. Think of it as glue. It's the magnetic attraction, you might say, by which you can hold on to these theta facsimiles, these memories. Well, you can run the effort out of them. You won't hold on to one anymore. You take all the perceptions of all the effort out of them, the whole facsimile will just disappear. Don't have to do it, by the way. Or you can take the emotion out of it and unglue it. If you can find what emotional band it's on, you just get the person running that emotion. The first thing you know, these things start to peel off. Quite remarkable. Or you can just run thought. But sometimes he is so aberrated that the thought is all mixed up in the emotion. And you have to run the emotion for a little while before the thought starts coming out of it. This thought is self-determinism. It's the original basic orders and evaluation of I. I says, be happy. So the guy tries to be happy. His body then turns on stuff to be happy. All right. That's self-determinism. This is the physical body which is acted upon by self-determinism. Now, the more an individual comes down this tone scale, the more the environment comes in here and just short circuits into action. Doesn't consult I. The body acts, in other words, without I's orders. This is your normal. This is what's known as conditioning. It's all sorts of things. It's not really what's conditioning. Conditioning is a little more technical than that, mostly because it doesn't exist. But anyway, here is the environment making the individual. Here's the environment being the puppet master. You as a body happen to be your own implement or instrument. The body is an implement or an instrument. You just look it over. Hands, feet. It's a carbon-oxygen engine. A very interesting engine, very complex engine. It's set up to run and it keeps on running. But that engine is acted upon by the self-determinism of the individual or by the environment. Now, by the way, did you ever work around anybody that when you picked up a screwdriver or something and tried to do something, they came along and said, let me do it, and took the screwdriver out of your hand? You ever run into anybody to do that? Who hasn't? Backseat drivers doing the same thing. They want the steering wheel. Car runs down the road. They've got a lot of facsimiles that have to do with sudden starts and stops. They'll put on the brakes or no brakes under them. So, but this business of taking the tool away from you is not much different than what happens in this aberrated world when a little kid comes into it and he starts to use this instrument called a human body. He finds out how it gets its coordinations going, finds out how to use it manually. He tries to train it into being. And somebody's always coming along taking the tool out of his hand. No, dear, you do it this way. You've done wrong. You should do something else. Why don't you do this? You've got to learn how to handle yourself. Yak, 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 yak. And after he's had this happen to him 8 or 9 million times, arriving at the age of 1 year, he's fairly well convinced that he isn't going to handle his own body, that he can't. By the time he gets to be 5, 6, 7, along in that bracket, he has achieved the astounding illusion that he is his body, that he is his own memory of himself, that he is not himself, in other words, to use himself, but he is He just is. He is a physical being. And out of all of this aberration, we get the astounding concentration on human structure, and additionally, the terrific concentration on the idea that the soul is somehow unknown, indistinct, off there someplace, and will someday go to heaven or something. There's where we get that idea. The individual is handled, in other words, by other things than himself, so much and so often that he gets to be a stimulus-response mechanism. And he is at the point where when the environment does something, bing, his motor switchboards actually respond, bing. Stimulus-response. Down here. Something happens in the environment, he responds. Not because he elects to respond, but because the environment has actually established a direct connection to his memory banks. Why does he operate this way? Is there anything physical that makes him operate this way? No, there isn't. All that has suffered has been his ability to handle his facsimiles, not to handle the universe. He can remember being handled one way and another, and these memories of being handled are called up. And he gets to a point finally where he no longer is able to handle his own memory. This package we started talking about called the unit memory was at first at his own beck and call. He could remember it or not remember it. It didn't matter how unconscious he was. It didn't matter how dead he was. It didn't matter how big he was or small he was or anything else. He could handle this memory. He could say, "Now I want to remember." There it is. "Now I don't want to remember." Gone. A psychosomatic illness is one of these memory units which has come into present time to such a marked degree that is glued so thoroughly in present time that a person pretends he hasn't got a memory there at all, he's got a physical illness. Well, isn't it funny that when you empty the effort or the emotion off of one of these memories, the person's psychosomatic illness goes away? Just like that. In other words, it's pain held in present time. It's a theta facsimile of pain. It isn't the actual energy of pain. There's no energy there. It's a picture of the energy of pain. And it's able to come up into present time. The environment will bring it up into present time. And here it sits. The person said, "Oh, my migraine. Oh, my migraine." He's actually suffering from, having been hit in the side of the head with a hammer by his baby brother or something of the sort. It doesn't matter. That's what it is. It's a unit memory. Person goes around, you think of a guy having a circuit. Something, he's got a little voice inside of his head that tells him he's doing wrong. "Well, he'll go ahead and do it, but I know it's wrong," this voice will say. "You'd better not do it," this voice will say. "Well, I guess I might as well do it anyhow, even though it will be wrong." "Well, you'll be regretted if you possibly could." You know, standard thinking. This argument that goes on, it's just mama or papa or somebody back along the track, and they've said very often this sort of thing. So there's a whole bank of memories of having been cautioned, 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 cautioned about this, about that. Critical, this way, that way, handling the individual. Of course, he gets these things in a package, and that makes up what we call the eccentricity of some individuals. Polite word for being crazy. Now, these are just facsimiles. There is no real reason why an individual cannot be in present time, in his own form, completely in control of himself, able to dictate to himself anything he wants, able to appreciate or not appreciate the beauties or pains of the world. There is no reason. Past memory is not necessarily the thing, although it appears to be. And he can be straightened up by processing past memories. All that's really wrong is not the individual's inability to handle the physical universe, not the individual's inability to handle the people around him, not the individual's inherent inability to handle himself, but only the individual's inability to handle his own facsimiles. So that these come in present time and he's responding to them and so forth. The environment turns them on, turns them off. How would you like to live in a house where the switchboard was out in the street? and every pedestrian that came by punched a new button.